Bryce Gill, an economist with First Trust Advisors, joins us today to discuss their recent Monday Morning Outlook post titled Soft Landing. We discuss the Federal Reserve, the tools it possesses, how it uses and sometimes perhaps misuses these tools, and how the spending policies of elected officials in Washington help or sometimes hurt the Fed's efforts. Stay tuned as we connect all this academic talk to your efforts to become a more informed investor right now on the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Welcome. You are listening to the Retirement Lifestyle Show with Roshan Lungani, Eric Olson, and Adrian Nicholson. This show is an exploration of ideas to help you work toward your ideal retirement. Get ready for the financial independence of your dreams.
Welcome to the Retirement Lifestyle Show. My name is Eric Olson. I'm one of your co-hosts along with Adrian Nicholson here today. Roshan Lungani could not be with us. Today, we're excited to invite a special guest, Bryce Gill from First Trust Advisors, who's come to help a couple novice or wannabe economists like Adrian and me understand more about a critically important topic for the near future of the markets and the economy that we wanted you to better understand and we ourselves wanted to better understand. And that is the underlying tools that the Federal Reserve has in its toolbox and how it can correctly or incorrectly use those tools, as well as First Trust's assessment from an economic standpoint about the right path and the wrong path for the Federal Reserve to follow now. And of course, First Trust, for those of you that don't recognize that name, is an established investment management company here in the United States. They have, as I recall, once upon a time had cut their teeth in a particular tool known as a unit investment trust and then grew out from there. And today are one of the leading providers of exchange traded funds in the United States. I know we use a fair amount of First Trust ETFs in our clients' portfolios and are very happy for the underlying algorithms or quantitative approaches that they use to design those and the ways that those have contributed to our clients' portfolios. That's not necessarily a recommendation for First Trust ETFs. Of course, talk to your advisor about whether that makes sense for you. But we have a lot of respect for them on the product side, and we have a lot of respect for them on the commentary side. The First Trust issues market commentary, but distinctively, I think, in a way that most other organizations don't do as well. They've made a long-term commitment to a lot of clear, and I would say at times, more maverick approaches to economic commentary. I don't mean maverick just to be sort of sporty and different from the crowd. I mean rather the deep convictions that they have been unabashed about sharing with the general public and with advisors as well. And, you know, lo and behold, despite being somewhat outside or an outlier at times in what might be considered the general consensus of opinion by investment management companies, First Trust's economic commentary, for the most part, has come through very, very strongly. Once upon a time, I would have characterized First Trust as perma bulls. And now I think I have to say a mea culpa. That was a mistaken assessment on my part. It was because I was something of sort of dispositionally bearish, and it just seemed to me, in contrast, that they were a bit too optimistic. But lo and behold, they're showing today that they can be. When now I'm feeling somewhat more optimistic, as I've said in recent episodes, First Trust's outlook is we'll let Bryce, our guest, speak for himself on what that outlook is. But let me just introduce Bryce. So Bryce is an economist on the team at First Trust. In addition to being an economist at First Trust, also has his MBA from the University of Texas McCombs School of Business and also a BA in Econ from Miami University of Ohio. So Bryce, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Eric, for having me. And man, what a wide-ranging and gracious introduction. I really appreciate it. And I'm happy to be with you guys.
Well, that's awesome. Adrian, anything that you would want to add to what I've said so far?
I'm just excited to get into today's episode. And Bryce, we're really excited to have you on the podcast, our first guest of 2023. So we're ready to kick it off with a bang.
That's right. Adrian, way to go. I love it. So that's a good distinction there as well. So dear listener, what I want to explain to you is, or use as our sort of our intro into the topic today is to reference, and by the way, we will include this in the show notes and a link to this in the show notes so that you can go and see this article for yourself. But each Monday, First Trust's economics team publishes a Monday morning outlook. And the one from immediately after Martin Luther King Jr. Day was entitled Soft Landing. And I read that during the week and I just thought, this is really interesting because it responds to a number of the persistent questions and uncertainties that I've had about the Federal Reserve and its applications of its various policy tools. And I thought, man, it would be awesome if we could get somebody in here from First Trust to respond to this. And Bryce, on very short notice, was gracious enough to find a time in his schedule this week that would work. So I just want to start, Bryce, by asking you to just give us a sweeping overview of what's the gist of this article, and what do you think are sort of the key points that First Trust is trying to make here about the Federal Reserve and its policies? And then we'll dig in and talk about specific ones of those policies and their application or misapplication in just a moment.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think the main thrust of the article, the main point that we're making is, hey, everybody is glued to the TV or glued to these Federal Reserve statements that come out about, hey, are we going to hike 25 basis points or 75 basis points? How high are our interest rates going to go? How long are they going to keep raising rates? And everybody's wondering this because, hey, that's how we're going to fight inflation, right? That's how we're going to solve this problem. You know, we got to a four-decade high, and the Federal Reserve needs to come to the rescue. And the point that we're making is, hey, we think interest rates, especially after 2008, 2009, and the massive changes that happened, how monetary policy functions during that financial crisis, we think interest rates are just the wrong signal to look at because they don't communicate the kind of information they used to, especially during the Volcker days. And we think a better way to look at whether or not we're making progress on inflation or not, and you know, I guess also along with that, whether or not a recession is on the horizon, is what's going on with something called the M2 money supply, which is, you know, what I would call high-powered money in economics. It's dollars in people's pockets. It's dollars that people can go out and spend. That was really the thing that set off alarm bells in our heads in mid-2020. The reason we started telling people, hey, M2 is surging like this. This time it's going to be different in regards to inflation than 08, 09. So, hey, we should watch the same signal today to see whether or not inflation is going to continue to durably make progress back towards that 2% target Federal Reserve has.
Awesome. And you just mentioned that inflation, that's something that's been on everybody's mind and really impacts people's bottom line at the end of the day. And it's something that people are worried about and concerned about. So could we get your thoughts more on inflation? Is it going to be sticky, and the road from 6% inflation down to 2%? How difficult is that going to be compared to the Federal Reserve getting it from 9% to 6%? How do you see that really playing out?
Yeah, so I think inflation's been massively overcomplicated the past few years. You know, there's no shortage of people writing 1,500-word essays about like every individual component of the CPI. I just think for normal people, this is the totally wrong way to go about explaining things. Inflation is what it's always been. It's too much money chasing too few goods. And when you think about what happened during the pandemic, we blew both sides of that seat. We printed up about $5 trillion, which for context, numbers get big enough, they don't mean anything. You know, that's what we spent on all of World War II, inflation-adjusted terms. And we sent out checks directly to the country. And at the same time, we shut down the global system of production, right? Lockdowns, factory closures, what have you, all over the globe. And so, hey, fewer goods, more dollars. That's how you get a 40-year high in inflation. And so, I think on the monetary side, the too much money side of things, whether the Fed likes to admit it or not, they are kind of listening to what we're saying. They have done a good job focusing on controlling the growth rate of the money supply. And so we're beginning to see progress on inflation. Like you mentioned, hey, we're down from 9% today to like 6.5%. Things are going in the right direction. I expect more progress just because the too much money side of the problem seems to be heavy, right? But at the same, you know, the same time, the sticky inflation that you mentioned, you know, I really think that comes from the too few goods side of the problem, and really the impacts. And really what I think like the long-term legacy of COVID policies we've seen are going to be on global trade, globalization in general. Globalization has been rising for over 100 years in the United States almost consistently. There's negatives to globalization. We've been living through those the past couple years, supply chain issues, everything else. But what does globalization do really well? It makes things cheap, right? You get to use cheap labor, cheap materials abroad. I would argue as globalization has been rising since, you know, the 1930s, or whatever it is, well, that's been this kind of consistent deflationary force for consumers. And now you think about what happened in the last couple of years. You know, on one hand, lockdowns completely just disrupt and destroy the status quo regarding global supply chains. You're starting to hear companies talk a lot and take a lot of action to bring industries back to the country, or at least shorten those supply lines, right? So maybe instead of China, now something's going to get made in Mexico. I don't think we're going to make like furniture or textiles in the U.S. again, right? Low margin manufacturing, but strategic industries like semiconductors, like green energy, like medical supply chain or pharmaceuticals. These are the types of things that are beginning to migrate home. And the bottom line is it makes us more self-sufficient, right? I think strategically it makes sense, but there's also a price to be paid with a lot of this. That really consistent upward force of globalization, I think, is going to reverse to some degree. Okay, then you add the fact that essentially overnight, right, this war in Ukraine happens. We kick out essentially a third of the globe by land from trade networks with the West, and especially in the commodity sector. You know, it's these supply chains have not been closed at all. At least we've got oil and gas production in the United States. We're kind of okay. We're not the ones having an energy crisis, but the Europeans are. I think globalization and kind of the legacy of lockdowns and all the chaos of the past couple of years is probably going to change the status quo there in a significant way going forward. And so, you know, that 2% number for inflation that's in everybody's heads, in my opinion, really was built on consistent upward trends in globalization. We think about what we call the Great Moderation, right? The past 40 years, low, stable inflation rates. Well, about a couple of years after Paul Volcker got office, the USSR, right? Half the world joins the Western markets. Lots of cheap labor, lots of cheap materials. 10 years after that, China joins the WTO, right? And so some of these major factors that have contributed to low inflation in the past 40 years are reversing to some degree. And I think that's going to be the sticky or difficult part of this inflation. Is what I would call like the too few goods side of the problem, or what the Fed would call structural factors. You have things outside of their control, right? They can't fix lockdowns, global trade, or wars in foreign countries. So that's going to be the sticky, difficult part of inflation, in my opinion. We'll make more progress, but 2% is pretty hard to do under current circumstances.
Well, that's a really interesting analysis, and tying in the globalization question as well seems very interesting to me. The one thing that I'll just throw out there, which you don't necessarily need to comment on, but so if the Russian integration at one point in the collapse of the Soviet Union or the disintegration of it, and then as you mentioned, China joining the WTO, these are obviously huge populations. My assumption is that there's still some opportunity for that with really large concentrations of populations, not necessarily equivalent to that of China, but in every case, at least. But I think India seems like it's increasingly integrated into the world economy. And one of the things I think is a longer term story, but I'm also really excited about, is economic development in Africa. It feels like there's finally the kind of formation in some places of an increasingly capable and expansive entrepreneurial class and small and medium sized enterprises there. So who knows, maybe we'll be having this conversation in another couple of decades and rejoicing about how economic development has bettered the physical quality of life there, and how that also then has spilled out as an additional blessing to the rest of the world in terms of potentially low inflation. I don't know, but I certainly hope so. But then one of the things that you had said, I mean you as institutionally First Trust, had said in the Soft Landing article that I thought was interesting, was this: all y'all who say that it's interest rates that will solve this problem and that inflation is a byproduct of too low interest rates. Hey, put your thinking caps on. What happened between 2009 and 2015 when you had this extended period of zero interest rates? At least the Fed policy was zero interest rate policy during that extended phase, but no inflation. If zero interest rates cause inflation, then as people are, some of at least are implying today, then why didn't they do so then? And said differently, we don't think it's interest rates that are the source of this. We think it is, and then these other things, disruptions, disequilibrium related to shutdowns in response to COVID, and it sounds like this ginormous expansion of money supply through a $5 trillion spend, in releasing the floodgates, the federal fiscal budget floodgates, as well as monetary floodgates. Is that a fair interpretation of what the article is saying there?
Yeah, and Eric, I think this is a really crucial reason why we emphasize M2, this high-powered money, this dollars in people's hands, because a huge reason why so many people got 08-09 off, there were so many calls for hyperinflation that never materialized, is they were looking at charts of the Fed's balance sheet going up and up and up. The Federal Reserve was printing money, right? Quantitative easing. And they assume, man, all this money is going to get into the economy. It's going to get into people's hands. They're going to spend it. Well, if you looked at the M2 money supply during the decade after 08-09, what you would notice is basically nothing notable happened. We didn't really see any of this money that got printed get out into the public's hands. And the reason why is we stuffed it all into the banks. We put it in excess reserves. We used it for Dodd-Frank capital ratios. For all intents and purposes, it kind of got buried in the ground. And I guess in some cases, kind of literally, right? It's probably a vault in New York somewhere. They really did bury the money in the ground. Okay. 2020, 2021 was very different. The Federal Reserve was increasing their balance sheet, just like they did in 08, 09. But at the same time, we pushed all this money out directly to the population, right? Stimulus checks, boosted unemployment benefits, PPP loans. And so it's really the confluence of fiscal policy, the Congress passing stimulus, along with monetary policy, monetizing all this new debt that leads to a boom in M2 money supply, right? And so that's the crucial difference between 08-09 and today. And the reason why we sounded the alarm in 2020 and didn't in 08 is that, hey, the money never got into people's hands. The high-powered money, the M2 money supply, which is what you should really care about, that never increased after 08-09. It posted its fastest growth rate in modern U.S. history during COVID. So that's the key difference between the two. Again, I think another reason to emphasize M2 money supply and not low interest. If low interest rates just mean, hey, we're printing a bunch of money and stuffing it in banks, well, there's not going to be a huge implication. And really, in a lot of ways, this is probably a good segue further on in the conversation, we've completely disconnected interest rates from money supply and inflation in general after 08.
Well, that is definitely a strand Adrian and I want to follow with you. And there's actually three strands that I also want to follow with you. One, let's come back to talk about interest rates in just a second. But since you've now verbally depicted the growth of M2 money supply, I want to show our YouTube viewers what this is. And also for the sake of our listeners, not our podcast listeners, as opposed to the YouTube viewers, we'll post links to the graphs that I'm about to show you in the show notes so that you'll be able to go back and get these. But I want to show what the St. Louis Federal Reserve's chart is showing the growth of M2 money supply over time and allow our viewers in particular to see just how incredibly powerful that move was in response to COVID. And then just before I show this, I also want to give you a chance, Bryce, I want to throw you a little bit of a curveball and to ask you to talk about velocity of money in just a moment, because It seems to me it's not merely the availability of, but it's the velocity of money that ultimately dictates how much economic activity there is, as well as I believe what the drivers of inflation can be. Too much money chasing too few goods, it seems to me, is connected to its velocity. But let me, to our listeners and viewers, as we said to Bryce, we'll say again, and we've said to you many, many times, we never, ever resent being told we're absolute fools and we're totally clueless about something, because that's how we learn. Hopefully you, our listeners and viewers, will learn from that as well. But let me share my screen and show this M2 money supply here. So here we are looking at a website from the St. Louis Federal Reserve. And I'm going to scale back and go to the maximum setting here on this graph, which is M2 money supply. And you can see way over on the far, far left, you're looking at February of 1959 and over time. It would be nice, I suppose, if this was logarithmic, because you'd have, a slightly better way of seeing just to what extent what's normative in terms of this growth rate and what is not. But you nevertheless can see a little bit of a slowing in the early 90s, at least relative to the pace that it had been on prior to that. Then starting in 1995, it started to pick up. When you get to 2008, of course, in response, unsurprisingly, in response to the global financial crisis, there was a bit of an acceleration of money supply, but then that was flattened very, very quickly to allow this to get back onto trend. But look way over here at what takes place in response to COVID. It's just suddenly, we use the term hockey stick maybe a little bit too loosely, and I would say that would be a little bit too loose here. But if we zoom in on that right-hand side, the last 5 years, there's no question that you see what was about $15.5 trillion of money supply in February of 2020, immediately before the world suddenly came to grips with the fact that, wow, this is not just a problem confined to China. This has global ramifications. Just 3 months later, and at the end of May of 2020, that's gone from 15.5 to 17.8. That's $2.3 trillion of additional money supply, or said differently, that's adding roughly in that one, in the 3 month period, roughly a sixth of all the money supply that was in circulation at that point has just been exploded. That's just a massive response. And it didn't just then, as we saw in 2008, 2009, they didn't level it out to wait for the rest of things to catch up. It kept getting pressed higher and higher and higher all the way here through January, February of 2022. So pushing essentially during that period for almost 20 or 21 months of continued growth beyond that, a full 2 years later then at nearly $22 trillion. You've essentially, in that short period of time, grown money supply by 50%. So any comments or observations about that graph?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my big observation is just that, and I think the really long time horizon shows, at least in modern U.S. history, we have never seen such a rapid increase in money in circulation in such a short period. I think, Eric, if you went back to like the Civil War days, President Lincoln's printing all the greenbacks up. I'm sure there's other examples in like free banking history of the United States where you saw money supply increase so rapidly. But in modern U.S. history, with modern banking, FDIC insurance, everything else, there's never been anything like COVID-19.
Yeah. Yeah. And then now, you had said earlier there has been and you gave, you know, props to the Federal Reserve for doing so since February, or arguably March of 2022. So now we're having this conversation in January of 2023. So over the last 10 or 11 months, they actually haven't been continuing to expand money supply. And if anything, it's been coming back down somewhat, so that now at the end of November, we don't have data for December and certainly not January, because we're not finished with it yet. But at the end of November at $21.35 trillion, then we are essentially back at levels that we were at precisely 1 year before. So further increase a little bit, but then a decrease. So no growth in money supply through the end of just net growth in money supply through the end of November of 2022. In the soft landing commentary, First Trust says, and that's a problem. I'm going to stop sharing my screen, but explain why that's a problem.
Yeah, well, absolutely. When the economy's expanding, right, there's more goods and services being produced. You essentially need to expand the money supply along with, right, facilitates trade and exchange. And when you think about like the Great Depression, for example, a big reason that was so catastrophic was, hey, a third of the banks in the country. And by the way, this is back before FDIC insurance existed. So, you know, Miracle on Fifth Street, there's no money at the bank, Johnny, or whatever. That was the, if the bank failed and your deposits were there, your deposits were gone. You weren't getting that. It disappeared, essentially, right? And so during the Great Depression, a third of the entire M2 money supply disappeared in a very short period of time. This was a major reason why the Depression was so bad. So, when all of a sudden the money supply slams to a halt, 0% or it even falls slightly, it probably means a contraction in economic activity is on the way. Nothing like the Great Depression. I know I use that as a comparison. That's not what we're really talking about here. We can get more into what we're looking at in this 2023 recession. I expect it to be much more mild. But yeah, basically, hey, there's implications to slamming the brakes on the money printer. I think ideally, if you could hold money growth to like 2 or 3% year over year consistently, that would be the pretty ideal solution. Overall, though, I think it would be pretty difficult after the monetary stimulus and all the COVID pandemic policies in the past couple of years to expect no kind of minor recession to occur. There's just so many distortions that have happened that, you know, really this recession is more just going to be a normalization after like the monetary morphine, stimulus, and everything else of the past couple of years. We never really felt the full pain of the policies that we instituted. That's really moral. So yeah, there are certainly implications to slamming the brakes on the money printer. Yeah, I can think of like a theoretically ideal amount they should be growing it, but the reality is, you know, hey, theory and reality don't often coincide.
All right, fair enough. Now, I had said that we would return to two other strands of the conversation. One was the discussion about interest rate policy, more from a philosophical standpoint, and it's the role that interest rates play in capital allocation generally. That's a different conversation, but I think an important one. It's a different conversation than the question of what should interest rates necessarily be today. Although you can certainly weave that in. And I also said we'd come back to the strand of velocity, but now you've introduced another strand. And since we're on it, I'll just ask you to comment on that. So would you say, since you've mentioned the ramifications of this now gradual decline in money supply since February, March of 2022, if you don't feel comfortable on this topic saying I can speak for First Trust, that's totally fine. But is it First Trust position, at least on this question, that the contraction in money supply is a necessary follow-on to the explosive prior growth in money supply? It is the tool of choice for combating inflation, but unavoidably it comes with some side effects that no one necessarily wants, including a recession, although we First Trust would say, while that's, you need to be aware of that, we're also not saying this is going to be a catastrophic recession. There's four parts of that. I'll let you untangle it. Is that the gist of First Trust message around the connection between money supply contraction gradually now and what to expect in the markets and the economy?
Yeah, well, I think that there's just a lot of trade-offs here. Like there are in pretty much everything in economics. It's all trade-offs. It's not really solutions. That was Thomas Sowell that said that. Mm-hmm. Greatest economist of all time. Now, you know, I think, hey, if you slam the brakes, you start contracting the M2 money supply, the benefit of that is it's probably going to reduce inflation, right? So it gets us back to 2%, approaching 2% more rapidly. The downside to that is, well, hey, unemployment probably goes up, economic activity contracts, we have a recession, right, of some sort. Again, I think more of a mild one. There's a lot of recency bias when we talk about recessions in the US, right? We had 08, 09, we had the COVID pandemic. I'm not expecting anything of that. Now, the flip side would be, hey, you hold the growth rate of the money supply, Historically, it's like 6% a year. So, hey, we grew way faster than that during COVID. Maybe we hold it to like 2 or 3% going forward. The upside to that is, hey, the economy keeps growing, maybe at a slower pace, but possibly we avoid a recession. The downside is inflation stays more durably above 2% for a longer period of time. Now, that I guess would be like the soft landing scenario here, right? And so is there a right answer? Frankly, everybody has different core values, different things that they're going to care about in a descending order, right? So some people are want inflation down faster. Some people are going to want, inflation higher, but unemployment staying lower for long. I don't know that there's necessarily a right answer for me to give you.
Mm-hmm.
It really just depends on, what you care about more.
Mm-hmm.
I'd argue if inflation's your priority, you want to see the Fed continue to reduce the M2 money supply. If you want to see a soft landing, you want to accept higher inflation and a lower unemployment instead. And that's, frankly, by the way, I think that's the Federal Reserve's ideal scenario. I think their overall dovish, they care more about unemployment than fixing inflation as fast.
That's interesting you should say that, because I guess I've just been reading commentary after, statement after statement by the Fed that it seems to me indicates, we find the sustained low unemployment and, the insufficiently not large numbers of jobless claims, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as a danger sign. And I'm thinking, do you realize what you're saying? You're basically saying we need to throw people out of work. I'm thinking, what kind of a policy, what kind of a messed up mindset is that? We need to throw people out of work. I grant that I just said something about my values on all of that. But am I misreading those statements? Is that, hey, we want everybody's attention over on this shiny ball over here while we actually do something else over here?
Yeah, and that's a big fear, because of just, that's what people are concerned about, are the Fed raising interest rates to such a degree that's really going to have some big impact? Have they already done it enough? I guess that's just a concern on everybody's mind.
Yeah, first of all, I don't think you're crazy, right? You look at the Fed statements and the things the governors are coming out saying, and they seem very hawkish on their face, right? There's no question about that. I think a lot of this is jawboning. That's what they call it in like the Fed world, right? Is trying to alter people's like psychology, market participants' psychology around this whole situation. When I say they're dovish overall, the Fed has a dual mandate. They care about maximizing employment and minimizing inflation. And so it's pretty easy to talk hawkish and get up there and raise interest rates 75 basis points a meeting when headline jobs numbers are adding back like 230,000, right? And that's been the reality for a long time. And so what happens when there's a trade-off that shows up in that dual mandate? There hasn't been one. And so I think that's the question. That's where really the rubber meets the road. It's pretty easy to be hawkish because there hasn't been a trade-off. What happens when unemployment starts to rise? I think you're going to see a lot of shifts in their language and things like that. And I will say this as well. 3.5% unemployment rate where we're at today, this is like a 60-year low, right? So this is not the norm. It's a good thing that lots of people are, no question about it. But, it's also probably not sustainable for an extended period of time either. So I wouldn't necessarily characterize this as like the Federal Reserve having direct responsibility for all this, right? Throwing people out of work. There's forces greater at work than that alone. But yes, I think, there's of course a trade-off between that dual mandate. That's kind of always been a tension between both sides. So yeah, I think look for shifts in how they kind of talk about this once a trade-off shows up. Famously, Paul Volcker, when he was doing his rate hikes, he'd get hate mail from the National Association of Home Builders on 2x4s, mailed to the Federal Reserve building, or like farmers would drive their tractors in front of it and protest. Back then he could just go to his lake house and like disappear, right? Nobody knew where he was. Today, everybody's plugged into the information sphere, right? Everybody's on social media every day. All these Fed governors are doing media hits with people that are going to care a lot about the unemployment rate going up. There's going to be an intense amount of public pressure on these people. Okay. And so I don't think we know what they're going to do yet. But my guess would be, those decisions are going to get a lot tougher once trade-offs show up.
Well, that's really interesting. I there's another tension that you mentioned in there now that I want to follow up on. But I'm going to keep that one a secret to come back to, because I promised we'd have I wanted to return to two of these earlier questions. One was the interaction or the role of interest rates in an economy, and perhaps some of the relevance of those philosophical views about the role of interest rates and the choice to now for a very, very long period of time have held rates to zero. And then now only more recently, as your article Soft Landing points out, yes, rates have come up, but they're still in against inflation. They're still lower than inflation. So on that basis, they're still not a real interest rate above zero. It's still a negative real interest rate at this point. So let's address that. Listeners have heard me say periodically that while on the one hand, I don't want to accelerate interest rates at a pace that create undue pain, I also do believe it's useful for us to live in a world where interest rates are not set by this godlike Federal Reserve, but instead are set by millions of market participants knowing what they believe the price of money, namely that's what an interest rate is, the price of money should be. If one lender says, I have some surplus cash, I'm willing to let that be in somebody else's hands for a period of time, if and only if they'll pay me something to rent that money from me for a while. And similarly, a borrower can say, I've got a project that I think has economic value for me or for others or for both. But I don't have the capital to do that right now. I could borrow that. Let me see what somebody would be willing to, you know, what am I willing to pay for money? And the interaction of one demand, that somebody who demands money or is seeking money, what their willingness to pay is, and somebody else who possesses more money than they know how to deploy right now, what their willingness is to take as an exchange for the opportunity cost of using that money, that becomes the interest rate. Why, when we lose that guidance or that price discovery about money, we're hosed in terms of the proper and the optimal allocation of capital. Now, some of our listeners may be saying, what is he talking about? And you may, Bryce, want to just either say, Eric, you're totally wrongheaded about that, or, you know, help our listeners understand why that's an important question.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right about all of that. Interest rates don't really mean anything anymore. And I don't mean that in terms of like, you know, hey, you get a mortgage, interest rates are higher. It means something in your life, right? Or you get an auto. It means something to you as an individual, you have a higher debt service. What I mean by interest rates don't mean anything is that the price of money, what we're really talking about here, isn't communicating information anymore, okay? And the reason why is, yes, there's been massive interference into the market for money by the Federal Reserve. And this all kind of starts back in 2008, 2009, okay? Before that, the way that we got interest rates, the federal funds rate, which is their interest rates, the Fed is increasing or decreasing, and it's the interest rate that every other interest rate is built on top of. The way that we got that is, hey, there is this market for bank reserves. Banks have to have a certain amount of capital set aside, right? A reserve ratio. So for every $100 or whatever in deposits, they have to keep 10% of it and they can lend out the other. All right. And so, hey, banks go and do their loans. And then at the end of the month, they'd have to, you know, make sure the books were in order, right? And they have to go out to the Fed funds market and borrow or lend reserves, if they had extra. But the Fed would come in and they'd either add or reserve add or remove dollars from that pool through open market operations, buying and selling bonds. And by doing that, by affecting the supply of dollars in the banking system, then banks would bid on all this money. And that's how interest rates, the federal funds rate, would be set, right? So it was set by market participants. There was information that was being communicated by this, based on supply and demand for cash, right? And so prices, especially in market economies, are very, very important. They communicate information. They solve the knowledge problem in society in a very simple way. Millions of people or banks, whoever, bid all on the price of money. And then at the end of the day, you get this one really easy to understand number that communicates, hey, what the entire system, what the entire group of people think about the current market for money, right? And so this all changes after 2008, 2009, all right? What happens is Fed does all of that quantitative easing, and like I mentioned before, they stuffed it into the banking system, right? They pumped the banks full of excess reserves. Now, there's a positive side, okay? The positive side is, hey, we don't have to worry about a financial crisis like we did in 08, 09, right? That was the priority. So banks are very well capitalized. They're not going to fail, even if some loans go bad or whatever. But at the same time, when you pump all these excess reserves into the system, now all of a sudden banks don't need to go out and bid for it. It's like they had to, right? Nobody needs it. Nobody's going to put a bid. They all have way too many of them. And so interest rates became divorced from supply and demand, a market condition at the very basic level. And so today, when you hear about the Fed saying we want to raise interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point or 75 basis points or whatever, you know, the Fed Reserve governors are just getting in a room and they're just setting that rate explicitly. Just like, you know, really, guys, the closest example really is like a Soviet command economy style thing, right? Where they're just coming up with this number out of thin air. And so, you know, Eric, what is the right, you know, level for the interest rate? I have no clue. You don't have any clue either. No individual person should have a clue, right? Everybody should just be trading with each other, trading money, supply and demand. The market sets the interest rate because in one little tidbit, you're getting the information of millions of people and their opinions about future and current production and everything else. And so there's no way Federal Reserve Board governors can do that better than the entire market, right? And so nobody knows what the interest There is nobody but like the all-knowing, omnipotent knowledge to know. And so today, interest rates really don't mean anything at philosophical level. They aren't really helping us allocate resources efficiently anymore, which is what prices do in a market economy. And that's why you're seeing all this, what I would call like malinvestment, right? The tech companies are the best example. You know, Twitter lays off 75% of its workforce, and the service works exactly the same, right? So they've just been misallocating capital for years and years and years. And you're seeing this writ large across huge sectors of the U.S. economy. That's just malinvestment. Just like in China. Hey, they build a bunch of ghost cities and high-speed rail trains to nowhere because it's central planning, right? They're just deciding to do it whether or not there's actually a market or demand for any of these services and final goods. Well, hey, today, what's happening in China? A massive real estate, right? The chickens are coming home to roost on a lot of this malinvestment. So when you start tinkering with these prices, it'd be one thing if they're like setting the price on bananas, right? Big picture, can't really cause a lot of damage. Really, I mean, the price of money is maybe the most important price in the economy, right? And so today, the way they really deal with this, the way you know, monetary policy works. Interest rates are kind of a sideshow. They don't really mean much anymore. And so instead, what they do is they have something called interest on excess reserves, and they pay banks not to lend money. So, you know, wrap your head around this. All those excess reserves that have been sitting there for decades, all right, the Federal Reserve is paying banks not to lend them.
This is
about $100 billion a year currently because they have to basically create an incentive not to lend them out. As interest rates drop,
it is one of the most puzzling things. I have a number of friends who are small business owners, and they're saying, "Yeah, okay, for that, maybe not so much today when interest rates have gone up a bit, but when during the zero interest rate policy, they're saying, you know, theoretically interest rates are really attractively low, but the bank won't lend it to me."
Exactly right. Yeah, I mean they're being incentivized not to. Now, hey, this is great. You're a banker, right? You're being paid to literally do nothing. To the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. But, you know, this is like a politically volatile subject, frankly, that most people have no clue this is going on. If this becomes more kind of widespread knowledge, you know, I think it's going to be a huge issue. And also, guys, you know, just keep in mind, we're talking a lot about monetary policy, how the Fed should tackle the inflation situation, everything else, right? There has never been a time in history where a central bank has fought inflation with this disconnect between interest rates and the money supply and market mechanisms, right? We've just never done it. So for me to sit here and tell you guys exactly how things are going to go, nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
They've completely changed how the system works. They thought inflation would never happen again. We banished it to the dustbin of history. Well, here we are amidst a 40-year high in inflation, and you know, they're doing what they can. But even the Federal Reserve doesn't know fully what the implications are. Mm-hmm. Nobody.
Well, I want to just advocate for our listeners here for just a second, because I can imagine more than a few are saying, what does this have to do with me? And I just want, because it sounds so theoretical. And so to our listener, I want to say the proper allocation of capital sounds like a theoretical concept, but it has real world consequences in both good and bad directions. Generally speaking, as a society, we want capital to be directed toward projects that actually have the capacity to create true economic value, so that the wealth creation process in the society has that sort of that capacity to cascade outward and support people's standards of living and create jobs and provide financial security for families and on and on and on. Misallocation of capital, though, has the adverse consequence oftentimes of creating bubbles out of categories of investment that don't really have the same economic value that other applications of that capital might have had if it was directed. Easy money creates bubbles. Bubbles for investors, and most of our listeners are investors, bubbles burst. And sometimes they bleed out slowly, other times they bleed out more rapidly. But in that sense, at least, things that went up more than they should have gone up usually come down more than you'd like them to come down. And I think anybody who is following, for example, this isn't a full attribution of this issue to interest rates, but anybody who's been watching the growth part, the tech part, the NASDAQ part of their portfolios, scratching their heads saying, wait a second, I thought this was the eternally fastest growing part of the market. Instead, seeing it get brutalized compared to other segments of the market, there's a connection here in terms of the misallocation of capital. So Bryce, I'm not going to ask you to render a commentary on that, because I do want to get to the other question, which was velocity of money. So money is, as you pointed out, there was zero interest rate policy coming out of the global financial crisis, and yet velocity of money collapsed by about, roughly in half, and it still hasn't come back. What is the velocity of money, and how does that interact with these questions of economic growth and inflation?
Yeah, so what velocity of money is, it's really a derivative to other series. One is GDP, okay, so dollar value of the entire U.S. economy in a year, let's say, divided by M2 money, which we've been talking about already, right? And you can also divide it by like M1. But typically, velocity is GDP divided by. What that gives you is the total amount of times an average dollar changes hands, right? So the faster people are changing dollars, changing hands, the idea is, hey, there's more commerce happening, right? And so higher velocity would basically mean, hey, a higher multiple on M2 with, a higher amount of GDP. That's kind of the idea here. Now, if you look at the chart of velocity, it started around, I believe, the 1990s. It begins to basically nosedive, falls off. Okay. Now, here's my theory about why this is. Okay. I think this all has to do with the US dollar being a reserve currency. Okay. A lot of dollars that are printed up and become part of the US economy, well, they go abroad, right? They get put in a central bank somewhere, or they're used as forex reserves, or they're used to trade between, Bulgaria and Jamaica. Are buying things from each other, right? They're using dollars, okay? And so a lot of dollars just leave the U.S. economy and are used abroad for either, central banks so they can create their own currencies and have reserves behind them, or to facilitate trade around the world. And so when we look at the number of dollars being created and we only compare them to the U.S. GDP numbers, it looks like velocity is falling off the cliff. Well, that's because a lot of dollars are used abroad. And so they're not showing up in U.S. transactions. So that's my opinion about it. Okay, I think that's why this velocity question has completely flummoxed so many people. They're like, why is velocity at a record low here? What would make velocity go way up? I think that's like a question that I ask myself. And really what it would be was like some kind of massive crisis of confidence in the dollar, right? All these dollars all of a sudden that are abroad come rushing into the country to buy real assets so they can get out of the currency. That's really what you have to see velocity take a massive increase. This is all just a reserve currency issue, in my opinion. Domestic velocity, dollars at home in the U.S., if there was a series that just mentioned, I bet it'd be going up, right, in the past 2 or 3.
Fine.
We don't have, right? It's all U.S. dollars around, basically, the only currency U.S.
Well, so, first of all, that's really interesting, and I wasn't aware of what's going, what was the case going all the way back to the 1990s, and I love your explanation of the way in which it grew to become, the dollar became a reserve currency, and how naturally that would mean people would be stashing it, at least in central banks and elsewhere abroad. But it also strikes me that maybe I have been, to a certain extent, misunderstanding it as cause and effect. Maybe it's not really so much cause and effect as merely just a description of a relationship of two things. If a money supply expands, that's the denominator in the equation that you gave, GDP divided by money supply. If money supply expands, the denominator expands, and if it expands faster than GDP expands, then hence that ratio, GDP divided by money supply, falls. And so a collapse in money and velocity may not be necessarily a description so much of people's behavior as it is, an insight into their behavior as much as it is, that's definitionally going to happen if you blow up the money supply. Is there any truth in that? Or no, it actually does play a more important role in providing us insight. It's more than just a statement of a ratio. It's a ratio with a purpose of giving us insight into something.
No, I really think you nailed it. It's like it's a derivative of two other things. We don't know about velocity until after the fact because it comes from two other series. So I don't think you can really look at it and have any kind of like predictive value from it. I do think what it does is illustrate how important the U.S. dollar is in international commerce, kind of international trade. And that's when you look at like velocity for the U.S., it's a different picture than a lot of places.
Bryce, you've been super gracious. Adrian, you too, insofar as you just allowed me to just kind of motor mouth on my questions here. I've got, Adrian, I want to say, if you've got a question, I want to certainly have you pose that, or maybe you've got more than one.
Yes, I have just one more.
Okay, go ahead.
Back to the soft landing piece, I guess, kind of get your parting thoughts on that for our listeners, because that's a term that's been coming up that a lot of people is on their mind. Is this recession, are we ready in one? Is it going to happen? Is it going to be worse, or is it going to be a lot easier? Can you talk about maybe the characteristics? Is a soft landing still possible, or is that out of the picture? And then what will it really look like? I know I'm asking you to put your future hat on and look in the future. I know that's tough for us to do, but for investors out there who are just wondering, should I just not even think a soft landing is going to happen? I shouldn't worry about it, or kind of get your last take on that.
Yeah, well, I would say, the Federal Reserve doesn't have a great record of engineering soft landings, right? I just don't think, by the way, their tools are that, intricate or like as fine tuned, right? A lot of times, really, what the Fed is doing, they're doing like brain surgery with the sledgehammer, right? They have a very blunt tool. And so the idea that they're going to be able to solve inflation without unemployment going up at all, especially when unemployment's already at a 50-60 year low, I find this pretty unlikely personally. I've kind of given my opinion on how they maybe engineer from like monetary side, right? Keep M2 growth like below trend, but still growing. Overall though, I think the big picture is, listen, there was massive distortions that happened to the economy during the COVID. Basically you saw, lockdowns happened. Everybody shifted their consumption from services to goods, right? And then we reopened everything and vaccines came out and people shifted their spending back from goods to service. And this is the fastest shift in consumer preferences that has ever happened. And maybe consumer preferences is not the right way to describe it because a lot of this was non-voluntary, right? It was government fiat. So, but you get the gist of what I'm saying. And so last year, we had those negative quarters of GDP growth, and we argued, hey, we're not in a recession. Hey, we get this is the rule of thumb. And the reason why was, hey, goods spending was declining, or you're seeing a bunch of layoffs at Pepsi or Target or wherever. But spending on services was increasing. Service is a bigger part of the overall economy. So the broader economy continued to grow. That's the big picture. Okay. Well, this year, you look at those spending categories, and spending on goods has further declined, but spending on services has mostly recovered. And so we just can't rely on services to continue to bail out the broader U.S. economy. It's not that the wheels are about to come off the bus or like we're on like the economic precipice, some massive collapse. Really, what we're talking about here is just normalization from extreme pandemic era policy. We haven't felt a lot of the pain yet that came along. It was delayed in the future. And so we're just kind of reaping what we sowed 2 or 3 years. And so overall, I expect this to be a moderate recession from an historical perspective. I don't expect it to last very long. It's just reallocating people back to what consumers want to purchase. And there's going to be, you know, obviously some friction as that happens, right? So I expect a recession here in 2023. I expect higher unemployment. I expect a decline in consumer spending and earnings. Is that the end of the world? No, I think it's basically something that has to happen in the wake of this pandemic, all these extreme policies that we're facing. Okay. And so I don't personally expect a soft landing. And I'd split that with those macro, just the shift in consumer preferences that happen.
Great question, Adrian, and really a powerful answer, Bryce. So here's the one other question that I have. I've got a million questions, but this is the one other question I have. And that is the interaction between fiscal policy and monetary policy. So our listeners are saying, what is the guy talking about again? So this is the Congress and the White House spending money versus the Federal Reserve setting policy about how much money there should be in circulation and what interest rates should be. So I'm going to make a hyperbolic argument here. And by the way, some of, you know, Bryce, our listeners understand that I tend to be more, I tend to lean a little bit more towards small government, constrained spending, you know, let's let civic society be more of the engine of a good society than necessarily having political society be the engine of that good society. So for my progressive clients and our progressive listeners, you know, please, you know, I appreciate your graciousness with me in asking this question. But it does feel as though, but both the Congress and the White House, since the pandemic, has been out front of the House, or just in the same time that the Federal Reserve has been out front of a burning house with a fire truck, trying to put out the fire of this raging fire of inflation. In the back, you've had the White House and the Congress also with a hose, but they're not shooting water on the house. They're shooting kerosene on the house. And what you're seeing as an example, the consolidated appropriations bill that here just got passed on the last 2-3 days of 2022, it's the, you know, this omnibus appropriations bill of $1.7 trillion for the federal government. It's just, it seems like we've become inured, I think is the term I'm looking for here, to the term trillion. Once upon a time, trillion would have sent shivers of fear up and down people's spines. Today, it seems like, you know, a trillion here, $2 trillion there, $5 trillion here. It's just like, it's just a number. It's not a number. The amount of gasoline or kerosene I was just using that's being shot out into the economy, it seems to me, it just makes the Federal Reserve's job that much harder because, again, the concept of too much money chasing too few goods. So you don't have to share that outlook, or you may think I'm crazy and I'm just a right-wing nut job. That's fine with you. It's fine if you could help me learn from what might be a mistaken understanding of my in my understanding, and as well maybe help our listeners understand, you know, is this this battle royale between parties with different mandates and different outlooks, or is there a way of seeing this as more harmonious than I'm seeing it?
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would say is, you know, we tend to look at politics, the federal government, in terms of like, the Republicans and the Democrats, and that's not really what I see at all. Mm-hmm. I think the federal government is its own interest group. It has its own desires. It wants to be larger and stronger and have more power over society. Mm-hmm. And there's this really great economic historian named Robert Hicks, okay? He wrote a book called Crisis and Leviathan after World War II. And he basically makes an argument for something called the ratchet. What the ratchet effect is it basically looks at the federal government and its size compared to the overall. His argument, when you go back through history, the federal government's role in society grows during wars, financial crises, and major emergencies, right? They use these I guess it's like Rahm Emanuel, right? Mayor of the former city of Chicago that I used to live in. He would say, never let a crisis go to waste.
Mm-hmm.
This is really the truth. I mean, the federal government is a percent of GDP. Before World War I was about 6% of the overall economy. Well, today it's about 35-40% of the overall.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so this is what happens. If you look at like a chart, well, hey, World War I hits, federal government goes way up, and it falls a little bit afterwards, but it never goes back down to where it was. Then World War II happened. Falls down, but doesn't really ever go back. COVID happens, financial crisis happens. And so essentially what we've seen is wars and financial crises and major emergencies shift power from, as you would call it, civil society, decentralized communities towards Washington, D.C. over time. And, I think, frankly, this is a big problem with, like, the reason there's so much political tension in the United States today. In the past, if it was like you're a Republican and there's a Democrat president, well, hey, they didn't have a ton of power over your life. They can make some changes around the edges, or hey, it's the reverse, right? It's your Democrat and it's a Republican president. You didn't care a ton. Today, they control a fourth of the entire economy, a third of the entire economy. Well, then you're going to have to fight like that to make sure they don't impose their value, right? And so we all become more political and more sucked into the political system because of this. And, you mentioned progressive friends, so let me speak to it from an egalitarian perspective. Okay, there's about 3 million federal employees. We vote for what? 1,000, let's say, right? A very small fraction are actually democratically elected to office. So most are employed for life, right? And they now run very, very small group of people. We're not talking about the 1%. We're talking about the 0.001% or whatever. Now run a third or a fourth of the entire U.S. economy, right? This is clearly unsustainable. And so, yes, I think, we're going to clearly see another ratchet up in the side of government and government power, especially at the federal level in the post-COVID era. They're using the crisis. They're not letting it go to waste. That's all these like 1,000-page omnibus bills that get, passed in the dead of night. Nobody has time to read them, right? We're going to be, figuring all this stuff out for years to come. And so, I think, yes, we need kind of like a change here. We want America as like a political unit to continue into the future. Really, the biggest risk is the calls come inside the House, essentially.
Well, I appreciate your responding to that. And I think that's a very erudite way of looking deeper into our history as a people and understanding, where we've come from and putting that all in perspective. Bryce, listen, Adrian and I really, really appreciate your being willing to join us and give us this amount of your time. You've been very generous with it. A shout out to our co-host, Roshan, who could not be here today. I know it when he hears this episode, he's just going to be green with envy that he wasn't able to be here to pose some questions as well. And he's probably going to be shouting at his audio player for some of the questions that I posed. But nevertheless, Bryce, it's been great to have you. Is there any sort of final thought that you'd like to leave with our listeners about what to expect in the coming year? I mean, you've covered a lot of it. And so a fine answer is no, nothing more to add. But I want to give you that opportunity if you have something final to say.
Well, I think we focused on things that, credibly should be criticized today about government policy and the Federal Reserve. And I've warned about, I think a recession that's on the way as a response to the COVID pandemic. And so I think I'd like to just wrap up with some thoughts longer term about the U.S. economy. and just speak to some of the major advantages we have versus our competitors in the world, because there's so much negativity out there these days. And it's like, why should I invest, right? Why, I'll just stuff all my money in gold or ammunition under the mattress and ride out the end of the day. And the reality is, listen, the American economy is going to continue to dominate. We have the best demographics in the developed world, okay? We're the innovators for the entire planet. Natural resources-wise, probably the most well-endowed country on Earth. We have the most, we're net exporters of food. We have the most fresh water on the planet in terms of the Great Lakes. We're the largest energy producer on Earth. And, you know, hey, on top of that, we probably have the best geography in the world. Two oceans, two friendly neighbors. We have navigable waterways, massive amount of infrastructure. Really, I look around the world, I don't see anybody that can compete with us. Maybe India has the best chance. They can really get their stuff together. China is in demographic decline. The chickens are coming home to roost for all the bad decisions that the Communist Party has made through central planning. Europe is a disaster because of their choices to become reliant on Russian energy. We're going to be fine in the United States, guys. And I think it's by far the best place to continue to invest for the long term.
Awesome. Well said. Adrian, thank you so much, man. Do you want to, I want to just give our listeners, and then Adrian, you can close us out. So listeners, we indicated to you that we'll have some of the resources for today's show available to you. So go to our website, retirementlifestyleshow.com, retirementlifestyleshow.com. And if you're catching it just as in the week that we've released it, it's going to be the first thing that pops up in front of you. If your podcast episode queue is a little long and you don't get around to listening to us for 2, 3, 4 weeks or whatever it might be, just go to the All Episodes tab up at the top, and then you'll be able in reverse chronological order to see what we have there, or just use the search tool and search for the conversation about the Federal Reserve, and then, or Bryce Gill, and we'll have that show will come up for you, and then you'll be able to just look at the notes and get what you want. Listeners, we also would say, we certainly hope that you're finding value in this. And if you are, then A, please share, but also please review. If you love what we're doing here, then go give us a 5-star review, and that will make it easier for other people to also discover the show. Finally, if you have said, man, there's some things in here that I would just love to have a conversation about, that's what Adrian Roshan and I do day in and day out, is have conversations with people who have questions related to either investment, markets, their personal finance, you name it. So don't hesitate to reach out to us. You're not under any sort of obligation to work with us, although you may discover that as a result of that conversation that you're curious to learn more, and that's fine too. So anyway, thanks so much for joining us. Adrian, anything that you'd like to add?
Nothing to add. This has been another great episode of the Retirement Lifestyle Show. Like Eric mentioned, please like, subscribe, tell your friends and family. And we'll be back next week for another episode of the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Schedule a conversation with Roshan, Adrian, or Eric today at retirementlifestyleshow.com. Roshan and Eric are certified financial planner practitioners. They, along with Adrian, are investment advisor representatives and serve clients across the U.S. with financial planning and investment advice through RHA Wealth. If you found this show helpful, gained knowledge, or enjoyed the time you spent with us, tell your friends and leave us a 5-star review. This will help others discover the show. To access our show notes, to download any of the tools mentioned in today's podcast, to ask us a question, or to schedule a conversation, go to retirementlifestyleshow.com. All opinions expressed by podcast hosts and guests are solely their own. While based on information they believe is reliable, neither RHA Wealth nor its affiliates warrants its completeness or accuracy, nor do their opinions reflect the opinion of RHA Wealth. This podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be regarded as specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. The show hosts offer investment advice through RHA Wealth Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor, and securities through RHA Wealth Management, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, and NFA.
Finally, our music is The Chance by Jason Shaw in Audionautics. It's part of the YouTube Audio Library, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons license. I am Ray Voices. Thank you for listening.